My brave lad, he sleeps in his faded coat of blue. In a lonely grave alone lies the heart that beats so true. They will find him and know him amongst the good and true, when a robe of white is given for that faded coat of blue. No more the bugle calls the wind.
Welcome to War of the Rebellion, Stories of the Civil War. I am your host, Leon Meowser, and this is a reading of the regimental history Under the Maltese Cross, Antietam to Appomattox, The Loyal Uprising in Western Pennsylvania, 1861 to 1865, Campaigns 155th Pennsylvania Regiment, narrated by the rank and file. And we are picking up right where we left off, Part 3 of Chapter 6, The Battle of Chancellorsville. The two divisions of the Corps, Sykes' Regulars and Griffin's Division, marched out very rapidly on a road in the direction of Banks Ford. Humphrey's division was ordered to follow and promptly did so, passing a Confederate encampment on the road, which gave every sign of having been suddenly evacuated but a few hours before. Brisk artillery firing while on this reconnaissance towards Banks Ford broke out and could be heard very distinctly by the command. But few of the shots or shells reached Humphrey's division, which, as stated, was in the rear of the 5th Corps column, but Sykes' division and Griffin's division received some of this artillery firing of the enemy. From some unexplained reason, Sykes' division, which thus came across the enemy as the head of the reconnoitering column, was given orders by General Hooker not to fight or bring on battle, and next was ordered to fall back to the place whence they started, near the Chancellor's house. A singular scene took place on the retrograde movement of this column, composed of the 5th Corps. As it was falling back, panic-stricken teamsters, pack mules, drivers, and a number of wounded prisoners, some contrabands, and the cattle train crowded the roadside and were in full retreat as if the enemy were following the troops, which General Hooker had sent out on this road to make a reconnaissance. General Sickles, at the head of the 3rd Corps, on the return of the 5th Corps from this reconnaissance, formed a junction with the 5th and 2nd Corps. Humphrey's division was detached from the Corps and assigned to a position on heights commanding the southern approaches to United States Ford. This was exactly the reverse of the position they had been picketing for 2 or more months previous on the opposite side. In taking this new position, strict orders were given to build no fires and to give no signs by which the enemy might know or discover the presence of Union troops occupying this position, and orders were also issued to be ready to fall into line at a moment's notice, virtually to sleep on their arms. Saturday, May 2nd, 1863. All this day, Humphrey's division was engaged in erecting earthworks, rifle pits, and other defenses on the heights occupied by the division. Batteries were placed in position, and a body of the enemy, gathering in the woods plainly in sight of the position occupied by Humphrey's division, was treated to a shelling by the batteries and driven from their position. The Battle of Chancellorsville was now on, and very heavy cannonading and musketry firing was heard close by, indicating the severity of the engagement. While still engaged in throwing up works, the 5th Corps received orders to march immediately to the right to assist in checking the advance Stonewall Jackson's attack on the Union left held by the 11th Corps. The 155th knew by the sound of musketry coming from this unexpected quarter that the enemy had broken through the Union lines, and the regiment double-quicked to the scene of the action. On the way, they beheld most astonishing sights. Panic-stricken non-combatants, cattle guards, ambulances, etc., completely choked up the road, impeding the passage, so that the troops were obliged to take a parallel lane leading to the front. This lane was also soon crowded with fugitives, proclaiming terrible news about the disaster at the front towards which the 155th was hastening. the 5th Corps, was ordered to relieve the 11th Corps under General Howard, and the latter, under orders, were marched to the rear to occupy the earthworks covering the approaches to United States Ford, which the 5th Corps had been engaged in erecting. Humphreys' division was soon under fire, and by the presence of these fresh troops, the stampede was partially checked, and soon the whole Union line was advanced and the lost ground recovered. As night set in without a cloud and the moon arose with unusual brightness, the 155th was posted in the woods, throughout which the cry of the whippoorwill was heard, furnishing a strange accompaniment to the incessant boom of heavy fighting, artillery, cavalry, and infantry, the roll of musketry and picket firing all along the line, lasting all night. Death of Stonewall Jackson. It was during these early hours of the night, about 9 o'clock, that General Stonewall Jackson lost his life while personally with his staff reconnoitering outside his picket lines, previous to rallying his forces and making a midnight assault on the Union lines. It appears that he was first seriously wounded by pickets firing between the lines, and while being carried back to his own lines, was again wounded. No convincing evidence has ever been gathered or submitted to establish the Confederate claim that General Jackson was killed by the fire of his own pickets, mistaking him and his escort for Federal cavalry. The close proximity of the Union lines, with skirmishers and pickets and the continuous firing in that vicinity, cast a shade of doubt over the Confederate claim that stronger proof than has ever yet been offered must be required to dispel. Sunday, May 3rd, 1863. The battle was resumed soon after daylight by furious attacks of the enemy under General Jeb Stuart, who had succeeded General Stonewall Jackson. Humphreys' division advanced from the rifle pits, which they had nearly completed, being relieved by part of the 11th Corps, and took position on marching to the front near the Chancellor's House. Allibach's brigade was immediately assigned to support a battery, and after remaining there an hour or more on this duty, stray shots and shells dropping around the position uncomfortably close to the regiment. The 155th and the 133rd Regiments were detached from the brigade and marched to the right of the White House, where General Hooker's headquarters were located, and where, with his staff, he seemed to be receiving reports from his subordinates. There had been fighting all along the line, and heavy skirmishing in the vicinity of the White House, which General Hooker selected for his headquarters. The enemy had range of the position and dropped many shot and shell in the immediate vicinity of the position occupied by the commanding general and his staff. General Hooker's deportment at this time was most soldierly and inspiring, and it was a matter of very great regret that soon after, while standing on the porch of the White House, a shot struck a column against which he was leaning and knocked him down, stunning him for some time. Instead of yielding to his injuries and seeking treatment, on first rallying from the effects of his injury, General Hooker insisted on mounting his horse and riding past the line of his troops to show that he was still alive and active. In this effort, however, the general overtaxed himself, the exertion required to maintain his equipoise being too much, and he broke down a second time, exhausted from his shock and injury, and was taken to his headquarters in an ambulance. He was there put to bed, and without his having made any provision or giving any orders concerning the battle then in progress, General Couch was the senior major general on the field, but in view of what was supposed to be only a temporary disability of the commanding general, and not knowing his plans, General Couch hesitated and refused to give any orders or in any way exercise control of the army, and, like the other corps generals, remained inactive awaiting orders. General Humphreys, after getting his division into line of battle, took occasion at this point to address each particular regiment of his command. With his staff, he rode up in front of the troops, and in a most excited manner, and accentuating his speech with vigorous gesticulations and profanity, demanded that each regiment of the division stand up to the work before them in the impending battle. To many of the division, who had so recently won for General Humphreys his high honors and reputation in the great charge at Mary's Heights, His address on this occasion was most surprising and was wholly uncalled for. Nothing in the conduct of the men in the ranks so far had given any excuse for the insinuations involved in this excitable and unexpected speech. General Humphreys orders reconnaissance. From the position occupied by the 155th and companion regiments of the division, which was in the reserve line of battle, the regiment had an excellent view of the columns of Union forces and the advance going into battle before it came the turn of Humphreys' division to move. While expecting at this point to advance in regular line of battle, the 155th and the 131st, which as stated had been detached, were deployed into the edge of the woods, where they observed before entering 40 or 50 pieces of Union artillery in line, with lanyards drawn, ready for action, all under command of Captain Stephen H. Weed, USA. Whilst the regiment was waiting for the final order to deploy into the woods, quite a number of Confederate prisoners who had been captured in the same woods passed to the rear of the Union lines. Also, many Union wounded being carried back while other wounded men were walking. A remarkable scene was also witnessed of a detachment of Meagher's Irish Brigade, accompanied by General Meagher himself and Colonel St. Clair Mulholland of the 116th Pennsylvania Volunteers, coming out of the same woods where they had very severe fighting all morning, pulling by hand and ropes the 5th Maine Battery of Artillery, the horses of which had all been killed in the fight. The defense made by the efficient officers and men of the famous battery exhibited some of the severest and most stubborn fighting of the war, its brave and youthful captain, Jacob Lepine, dying a true soldier's death at his post. Among the officers whose regiments were actively engaged in the same woods defending Lepine's battery was Lieutenant Colonel William B. Nieper, whose regiment, the 57th Pennsylvania Volunteers, was in the thickest of the fight. Colonel Nieper was well known to Colonel Kane, Major Pearson, Adjutant Montooth, and many other Pittsburghers in the 155th, having long been an active member of the Duquesne Grays of Pittsburgh. At last, the order was given for the 155th and the 131st to advance from behind the position of the 54 pieces of artillery already mentioned, in line ready to shell the enemy in the woods. The military term for the duty of these two regiments is called feeling the enemy, but in point of fact, it proved to be the enemy feeling them. The two regiments named were ordered to go into the woods and advance silently as close to the enemy as possible, and that if attacked by the Confederates from behind works or by their batteries, they were to lie down flat on the ground to escape the range of the enemy's massed artillery and musketry. And that, on no account were they to advance farther or to attempt to carry the enemy's works. At the first advance into the woods, the enemy evidently did not know of the approach of the two regiments, and no shots were fired. A rather humorous incident took place at this time. Major Pearson, deeming it a proper occasion to imitate General Humphreys' inspiring address to the 155th, made a speech demanding that each man stand up to his work, that no hiding behind trees or holding back should take place, etc. He had scarcely finished his impassioned oratory when the enemy, discovering the presence of the two regiments in the woods, opened out about as brisk a grape and canister and musketry fire upon them as they did on Mary's Heights, so that without express orders, every man in the 155th fell flat on the ground, including the redoubtable Pearson, who, his men afterwards claimed, got a little nearer down and hugged Mother Earth a little closer than his men. The range, however, of the Confederate artillery and musketry was all above the heads of the prostrate men. Soon, the enemy ceased firing and, jumping over their breastworks, advanced to capture the deployed troops. General Humphreys, however, who was present and on the alert to the situation, ordered the men of the two regiments of his command to arise instantly and retreat as promptly and rapidly as they could, so that the 54 pieces of artillery under Captain Stephen H. Weed could let loose their fire on the pursuing foe. This movement, ordered by General Humphrey, was executed, to use a hack guide's phrase, with quickness and dispatch, and the pursuing foe received the volleys of a most destructive fire from the awaiting artillerymen, and the woods in which the two Union regiments had been deployed was soon covered with the bodies of dead and wounded Confederates, whose charge was repulsed with severe loss. As the two regiments of Humphrey's division were falling back from the woods, the famous Chancellor's House in the rear could be seen burning. As the two regiments of Humphrey's division were falling back from the woods, the famous Chancellor House in the rear could be seen burning, having been set on fire by the shelling. The enemy's batteries resumed shelling the same woods and around the White House, which was still Hooker's headquarters, and near where Humphrey's division was stationed and again exposed to desultory firing. General Hooker's continued disability prevented any general advance or movement, but during the night of this day, May 3rd, the regiment furnished details consisting of 100 men with similar details from other regiments to throw up rifle pits at this point, and when completed, as they were towards morning, Hayman's brigade of the 3rd Corps occupied the position. The weather was extremely cold for the season. The 8 days' rations had not held out. The overcoats and blankets had been thrown away on the march, and as a result, there was considerable discomfort experienced by many of the troops. General Whipple's death, affecting scene. May 4, 1863, skirmishing with the enemy's pickets was kept up all day in plain view of the position of the 155th in the rear of the skirmish line. The regiment, from its position in reserve, saw General Emil W. Whipple, a distinguished officer commanding the 3rd Division of the 3rd Army Corps, mortally wounded by a Confederate sharpshooter while the general was standing by or leaning against his horse riding an order. Stray shots struck others near where the general received his mortal injury. August Schmuck, of Company K, was wounded while taking observations and sighting a piece of artillery away in reserve of the skirmish line. General Whipple was carried on a stretcher past the line occupied by the 155th on the road near the White House, followed by his staff. His wound being mortal and death imminent, the unusual spectacle was beheld of the stretcher bearers stopping and depositing the stretcher with its occupant on the roadside, while Father O'Hagan, chaplain of the Excelsior Brigade, knelt down, as did all of the general's staff, mournfully following, and the consolations of religion were administered to the dying man, and prayers appropriate for the occasion were uttered. It was truly a sad and pathetic scene to witness. The spot where the solemn ceremony took place was still within the range of the foe's sharpshooters, but no further casualties occurred at this point. General Whipple passed away within half an hour of the time of receiving the dying sacraments of his church. General Whipple had a distinguished career on the peninsula, being one of Hooker's ablest lieutenants, and was beloved by his men for his soldierly qualities and courteous treatment of his subordinates. General Whipple was one of the old regular army officers, being a graduate of West Point and participating in the Mexican War and also commanding a division at Fredericksburg. His death caused profound sorrow in Washington, where he filled various military positions and enjoyed the personal confidence of President Lincoln. After his death, the president interested himself to secure the appointment of General Whipple's 2 sons, then in their school days as cadets at West Point and Annapolis, respectively, where both in due time graduated. Charles W. Whipple, on the outbreak of the war with Spain, was made chief ordnance officer with the brevet rank of colonel, and after the close of that war, was dispatched to the Philippines, where he continued to serve the government for several years, until his arduous duties and the Bayful climate so affected his health as to cause his retirement. His brother, who entered the Navy, did not long survive his graduation. General Whipple's remains were removed to Georgetown, D.C., and were given the honors of a public funeral, which was attended by President Lincoln and Cabinet. General Warren in the Trenches. A detail under Lieutenant James Wells of the 155th Regiment reported quite early on the morning of May 5th at General Hooker's headquarters, which had been moved a mile or two back beyond the range of the enemy's fire. the headquarters consisting of a wagon converted into a tent. General Hooker, when the detail reported, was pacing the ground in front of his tent in deep thought. He was evidently very weak and fatigued, for suddenly turning from his walk, he entered his tent and wrapped himself in blankets. The detail from the regiment, in connection with those from other regiments, and all aggregating 1,000 men, was put to work constructing an immense line of fortifications under the direct charge of General G. K. Warren, Chief of Engineers. The work was difficult at best, but was increased by heavy rains, which made the ground soft and muddy, and the men were kept hard at work. Here, an incident occurred, which many who served on this detail will recall. General Warren, in charge of the construction of these works, noticing that some of the men and boys detailed were inexperienced in such work and unfamiliar with the spade and tools, in a most kindly manner got down into the trenches personally and affectionately, as if he were a brother of the soldiers, took shovels and picks from their hands, and showed them the knack and skillful way to use the same in throwing up earth. The general, in thus educating the men in the use of the tools, must have gone along the entire line and thrown up perhaps a couple of hundred spadefuls of earth. This event was the first introduction of General Warren to the members of the 155th Regiment, and in fact to Humphrey's division. At first, so modest was he and kindly in his action that no one suspected him of holding the rank of Brigadier General, as he had no sword or epaulets or style indicating his rank. Being intent on the work before him, he had no time for such ornaments. This work, however, was all in vain, as during the night Hooker's disability continuing, and no one superseding him or assuming the responsibility, there was no alternative but to abandon the action and retreat across the Rappahannock. This was rendered the more necessary as the river was rising and the pontoons were in danger of being swept away, and there would have been no way of supplying the army had it decided to remain on the south side of the Rappahannock. Humphrey's division was again honored by being made the rearguard to cover the retreat of the army across the Rappahannock, as it had crossed the same stream under Burnside in the previous December. The Army of the Potomac, as already intimated from this account, had been evidently not defeated, because not more than one-third of it had been actually engaged in the battle. The allegation was made, at that time, that General Hooker's incapacity to command his army at Chancellorsville arose from intoxication. The men of Humphrey's division, who saw him on that occasion, until disabled by the injuries at the White House, are living witnesses to the injustice of this charge against General Hooker. His strategic ability, displayed in reaching the battlefield at Chancellorsville, so promptly with nearly 125,000 troops and springing a surprise on Lee, is itself a tribute to his character and refutes the charge that he had been drinking or exhibited any evidence of it to the observer. Up to Chancellorsville, the rapid movements of so large an army and the laying of pontoons crossing the streams with such celerity and concealment from the enemy was unprecedented and stamped Hooker as a general of exceptional ability in the matter of prompt and successful movement of large armies. However unfortunate it was that his injuries disabled him and prevented his successful execution of plans to engage the enemy at Chancellorsville. Movements of 155th. While the 155th was, as the foregoing itinerary of the regiment's participation in the Chancellorsville campaign shows it to have been, under fire at several different places, both on the reserve firing line as well as on picket and rallying to check the disaster to the 11th Corps, very fortunately, the casualties were comparatively slight. This was due to the fact that none of the regiments of the 5th Corps was called upon to make assaults or charges upon the enemy's lines, although sleeping upon their arms and ready at all times to do so. In the advance and deploy of the 155th, and 131st into the woods, as already mentioned, near the Chancellor House, these two regiments were used as a decoy to draw the enemy from his works in pursuit, so that the assembled 54 pieces of artillery, under Captain Weed USA, could be used on the pursuers, hence but little loss was sustained. Adjutant P.S. Noon, of the 131st, was killed in this advance in the woods. He was a most popular and gallant officer, having made many friends in the 155th. He was a practicing attorney and a resident of Ebensburg, Cambria County, Pennsylvania. Many pickets and guards of the Union Army on duty were abandoned at their posts, lest their earlier withdrawal might be discovered by the enemy, and the retreat, which General Hooker was anxious to conceal, made known to the Confederates. The 100 men of the 155th, as already described as detailed to construct earthworks, received no notice of the intended retreat of the army until midnight. When they, by mere accident, discovered the passing of the columns of the 1st and 2nd Corps troops in full retreat for the United States Ford pontoons, with wagon trains hurrying to the same destination. Lieutenant Wells, in charge of the details on making this discovery, hurried back to where Privates O'Neill, Jones, Walters, Hayes, Morgan, and others were sleeping. He hurriedly aroused the men, barely in time to cross the Rappahannock, with the last troops crossing on the pontoons. Just about daylight, the last of the Union Army reached the North Shore, but not until the enemy had been aroused and fired some shells across the Rappahannock, with no other result, however, than to hurry up the retreat. All righty, my friends. At that, we come to Chapter 7. And we will finish up Chapter 7 next week. So for our show notes for Episode 12, I have actual announcements this time. Can you believe it? My first announcement, which is the most important, but I also want to get this out of the way before we talk about our podcast today. First of all, my website posts will now just be one page per episode, and everything's going to be in that page. I'm just cramming it all in from top to bottom. And I think for moving forward, that's just going to be the best thing that we're going to be able to do, because otherwise I'm going to have like 30 million different posts about different people, and I'd rather just have all the information on one page for you guys to look at instead of having it broken up into multiple pages. The second most important thing is you can help save Slaughter Pen Farm, which is the heart and soul of the Battle of Fredericksburg. And that's the title of the YouTube video that was released by the American Battlefield Trust. And so I'm going to condense it down for you. It's only 3 minutes, but I'm going to make it even smaller. When they originally bought the battlefield, they had to purchase it for $12 million. They had to get a $6 million loan on it. And somebody has approached the Battlefield Trust and said, if you raise $400,000 this year, which they were planning to do anyway, somebody else, this mysterious donor, will then pay for the remaining $800,000 in debt that they have on the Slaughter Pen Farm, which is a part of the battlefield. We're talking about American Battlefield Trust. This is what they do. And these guys are the number one organization in the United States that preserves battlefields. And it's something they still do amazingly to this day. So please, I'm going to link them down below at their website and their YouTube channel. Please go check it out in the show notes. And if you can spare the money, maybe you'll donate a little. Sometimes their work also gets transferred over to the National Park Service. Not always, but anyway, they're wonderful. They're worth supporting. Go check them out. And the last item that I have today to talk to you, it's just a small plug, and it's for a game that I play called War of Rights. I'll link it below. It does have an age rating, so children probably shouldn't play it. It's a beautifully made first-person Civil War regimental combat game. If you haven't checked it out and you love the Civil War and you like gaming, all of your people are here, all right? If you want to fight at the Battle of Antietam at Bloody Lane and discuss with the guy next to you why the Confederates should have won at Antietam, I don't know, whatever you like, you're going to be able to do it here while you're in the middle of the firing line. It's pretty great. And the graphics are great. It's just like you're there. It looks like a movie, to be honest. Check it out if you like the Civil War. A lot of different regiments have sprung up around the game, so you can join the United States Regulars or the 30th Ohio, and so on and so forth. There's all these different regiments that you can play with. And that kind of weeds out the bad actors, because then you're just really there to have fun. All right, so let's get on to the episode now. Chancellorsville. I really enjoy that the first thing that the 155th has to do when it crosses the Rappahannock is stand across the river from the spot they would normally stand across on the other side of the Rappahannock. That's like, we did it, boys, we made it across the river. Now go stand and look at your old position. I had to reread that part of the podcast because I just chuckled so hard. And my other show notes. So they've got about 1 million YouTube videos on the Battle of Chancellorsville. The rebels break through the Union lines with Jackson's entire corps because he marched all the way around the Union flank and attacked it where they didn't know they were going to be attacked at. And that's where all of like those panic-stricken people are coming from. You know, like, turn back, you know, Stonewall's winning, or however they were doing it on the battlefield at that time. Like, yeah, they got taken by surprise by a lot of Confederates, so I'm sure it was scary, but nothing any of the other corps at that time just couldn't counter with. And on a secondary note, there's actually a lot of debate about whether that ride around the Union Army was even worth it, because it achieved a tactical objective, but it didn't strategically change anything. We're also going to talk about Stonewall Jackson dying. So for a long time, there was contentious debate on how he died, whether it was the wound that killed him, or the doctors, or the illness, or something like that. It's been hotly debated for a long time, and I'm not really going into it. But we do know is that he was shot by the 18th North Carolina Regiment. So they were the ones that opened up in between the lines. Back then, I don't think they knew, but now we know. We've been able to narrow it down that they were on picket duty. Unfortunately for Jackson, they were specifically looking for Union cavalry. But since no one's sure exactly what killed him, because he was only wounded here, and then he died 10 days later, that's the whole part that's up in the air. But as far as I understand it, Jackson killed Jackson, because generals being shot by their own men was few and far between in this war. I mean, they even dropped him while they were carrying him on the stretcher. They had a rough go of it. All right. General Jeb Stuart taking command of Jackson's corps. Rumor has it that he really wanted this after the battle, and he didn't get it. He got stuck with leading the cavalry corps. Bet he was a little angry that he didn't. Those are all rumors, but you know how rumors go in conflicts and wars. And if you've been in the military, you know how rumors go. My goodness. So we'll see how the rest of the war shakes out for old Jeb Stuart there. The fact that this regiment just happens to be everywhere where something important is happening is just lovely. First at Fredericksburg, then right here with General Hooker during the battle, and afterwards, like, getting to see him, getting to see Lincoln. I'm kind of jealous of the history they got to see, although I'm not jealous about how they had to see it. And also the 155th, watching the army march off into lines of battle, is pretty neat. I once had someone describe to me that war just seems like you're winning and you're winning and you're winning until you're no longer winning, and then that's the thing that beats you. I feel that was perfectly described for the colonel's perfectly timed speech while the 155th was out feeling the enemy, and having that speech get cut short by artillery and musketry is hilarious. And if you wrote that into a book, people would call it out for being predictable. I just absolutely love them, like, skedaddling on out of there to the cannons protecting them. But those rebels, can you imagine what they felt like chasing the Union off like that? Probably doing the rebel yell, only to be met with a wall of canister and shot and shell from 40 or 50 cannons. That was a bad day. General Whipple's death, I have his picture up on the website, along with every picture that goes along with all of the pages that I've read today. Those will all go together. It'll just be titled Chapter 6, Episode 3, 3 of 3. Also, a man named Schmuck. That's just unlucky. Like, I'm sure that man had a full life and has descendants and everything else, but here I am talking about him 100 years later. And the only thing I wanted to know is just be like, Schmuck. Who were you, Mr. Schmuck? With a name like that, unfortunate. All right, let's also talk about General Warren, because he is awesome. I'm glad he makes an appearance here. So go read about him. I'm going to put a link somewhere down below. You can go there. Or you can go to rebellionstories.com. You can read about it there too. But him just like helping out in the digging for all those men, like doing entrenchments. That's right up. That's exactly what we know about him. Fits right in with his character. Also, we should have a discussion with the commanding generals of the Army of the Potomac, always leaving their pickets behind, who are just like getting over the pontoons at the last minute. Like, someone needs to talk to those guys about just letting your boys know that you're moving. General Hooker not leaving any orders for anyone. So he gets a concussion because he's leaning on a column at the White House. This is a separate White House, not the one in D.C. And he's leaning on it, and it gets shattered by a cannonball. He should have been relieved of his command until he was well enough to come back, but nope. Like, well, guys, he's the commanding general, and he's in bed right now, so I don't know what to tell you. It's like generalship 101 is just to tell your corps commanders what's going on. But the corps commanders also know, because of the political nature of being a commanding officer, or commanding general, I should say, is that they might get fired, but you get to keep your job. And a lot of them genuinely like being corps commanders, and they're really good at it. So not wanting to stick your neck out for that is just, you know, it can be something that you got to work up to, I suppose. And as we'll see, General Meade does. And then also at some point, General Hooker, he calls like a vote of all the corps commanders asking if they want to fight or retreat. And it's like 4 out of 3 say fight and 3 out of 4 say retreat. So General Hooker sides with the retreaters, making an equal vote, and then they all go home. And it's like, I think at this battle, when you look at the numbers, it's something like Robert E. Lee's got 50,000 troops and the Army of the Potomac's got 120,000. And he still wastes the opportunity. But we'll see how that shakes out in the future. Next week, that's it for today, my friends. Please like, subscribe, comment, or criticize. Give me that 5-star rating on Apple. It helps my show get found. And I really genuinely want to build a community around this. So I have a Discord that I'm putting together. Oh, and also, if I seem a little bit sick today, I'm not sure if it comes across. I got my booster shot, and so I've been feeling under the weather. I will see you next week. Bye-bye. That faded coat of blue. No more the bugle calls the weary one. Rest, noble spirit, in thy grave alone. They will find you and know you amongst the good and true. When a robe of white is given for that faded coat of blue. He cried, give me water and just one little crumb. And my mother, she will bless you through all the years to come. Go tell my sweet sister, so gentle, good and true, that I'll meet her up in heaven in my faded coat of blue. No more the bugle calls the weary one. Rest, noble spirit, in thy grave alone. They will find you and know you amongst the good and true. When a robe of white is given for that faded